Welcome to We Watch Movies. My name is Forrest. I will be your host for this episode. And joining me today, as always, is my good friend and host, Elijah. Elijah, how are you doing today?
I'm not bad. How are you?
Good. I'm doing pretty well. Doing pretty well. Got a good night's rest. I'm ready to go after watching this film yesterday.
Great. I watched it Friday afternoon.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
no, I have not seen this film since I think the last time, well, when I was up with you and you and I watched it was the last time I'd seen it. So it had been a bit while.
Yeah, same. It had definitely been a while. But I'm glad we got to watch it because it's really good.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it holds up really well on second and third and fourth and fifth viewings.
Absolutely. I kind of want to just dive right in. Let's do it.
Yeah. Give me a couple housekeeping things before we get into it. If you want to follow us and see what we're doing on the podcast each week, you can go and follow us on Instagram at We Watch Movies Podcast. I run it. Try to post daily. But you'll at least see what we're doing on the podcast.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for running that.
No problems. And then, just a spoiler warning for Blade Runner 2049. We're going to be jumping into it, talking, or you could imagine. So, if you haven't seen it, I'm not quite sure what you're doing here.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Go watch it.
We're going to go ahead and hop in here, Elijah. So Blade Runner 2049 is a film that I think is one of Elijah and I's favorites. I saw it and the original, I think, back to back, I think in the early 2018 and late 2017 after Blade Runner 2049 came out and flopped at the box office.
Makes me so sad.
Yeah, and I'm interested to talk to you about why you think it may have flopped, but before we get to, I do want to just give my overall thoughts on this film. And watching it again last night, the thing that stuck out to me like a sore thumb is how visually stunning this film is.
Yeah, it might be the prettiest movie I've ever seen.
I was thinking the exact same thing. Everything from just the lighting, the colors on the screen, the settings. You think of that, the fight at the very end between Kay and Love, that whole sequence is absolutely stunning. Roger Deakins is a master, but I mean, we've said that 100 times before.
Yeah, I found it interesting because Jackie was kind of walking by occasionally while I was watching it, and she said every time she looked by, she felt like the environment and the scene was a different color, which mm-hmm. is super cool because it is. There's very distinct yellow scenes. There's pink scenes. There's like white and gray scenes.
Yeah.
The cityscapes and the police office are kind of more bluish. It's amazing.
Yeah. And there are so many, it's almost as though every shot is composed as if it was going to be a painting. I mean, there are so many iconic scenes that you could be like, yep, that would be a poster. That would be a poster. That would be a poster. I think one of the ones out glaringly in my mind to fall into that category would be the scene where he's walking through, I guess it's the ruins of Las Vegas there.
Kind yeah.
Pan up, pan down, and the whole thing's just oranged out.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see a silhouette.
It's incredible.
Yeah. No, there's so many great things. Then advertisements within the city like Coca-Cola or Atari, and those
the classic ones. I love the classic Atari sign.
It's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Story wise, I think this is I think you gotta pay attention a little. I think at the end that here in a little bit, I think the end maybe falters just a tiny bit, but at
heck and, no, you're wrong.
No,
you're so wrong.
Well, if you would let me finish my thought, I was going to say, I think waver at the coming in at the climax, but after the climax, it's just brilliant.
Oh, I see. So not the ending, yeah. But the ending before the ending.
I have one critique of the lead up to the ending, and it pertains to one specific character, which I think overall throughout the story could have been handled better. So those are my overall thoughts. Love this film. Also, I believe it's Hans Zimmer on the score.
Yep.
And he was absolutely brilliant. His score is much more of a soundscape than Vangelis' original score, but yeah. He uses moments of synth very tastefully in an era where synth it's looked at as dated. So those moments of using that synth just, I think, was very tastefully done. That's my general thoughts, at least on the visuals and the score. Watching it again.
Yeah. I think it's safe to say we both love this movie. It's a masterpiece. What stands out to me, something new every time, is Denis Villeneuve's, the director's, just visual, like, callbacks and storytelling. One of my favorite little moments in the movie is after, in the opening, when Kay kills Sapper Morton, we get a brief overhead shot of him washing the blood off of his hands. And then later in the movie, when we see kind of the quote unquote replicant birth scene, after Wallace, played by Jared Leto, deals with her, the new replicant, we see a mirrored overhead shot very briefly of him washing the replicant goo off of himself. And it's kind of a mirrored image of Kay killing a replicant and Wallace, who creates them. I thought that was really cool. Just, there's so many little directorial details like that that really make the whole thing feel cohesive. We could gush about the visuals all day. One of my favorite shots in the movie is in the opening scene again, when Kay gets out of his cruiser for the first time and he's just shrouded in steam and fog. That's such a cool shot. I love that shot. Like you said, every single frame could probably be a desktop background.
Yeah.
But what I think the most important thing here, being a Blade Runner sequel, is the narrative as a whole. And I think it perfectly builds on the concepts of the first one and follows up the story of the first one without, like, relying on it as a crutch, like a lot of sequels do.
Right.
It is definitely its own story, and it is definitely a super interesting story. Maybe it's one of the best explorations of humanity and what makes you human I've ever seen. And it's just, on top of being just interesting conceptually with this whole idea of a replicant that has a child, it's also just a really sad character study of Kay, who is one of my favorite characters of any film ever.
Right.
And I'm sure we'll get much more into that. But overall, it's firing on all cylinders. There's not really, like, any glaring weakness outside of nitpicks in my eyes. The performances are great. It's real good. So good.
It is so good. And before we get any further, I'll just read that opening, the opening screen crawl just for the...
By the way, when I saw this screen crawl, I got chills at the last line. It's so good.
it's as Elijah says, it's so good. Here we go. Replicants, for use off-world, their enhanced strength made them ideal slave labor. After a series of violent rebellions, their manufacture became prohibited and Tyrell Corp went bankrupt. The collapse of ecosystems in the mid-2020s led to the rise of industrialist Neander Wallace, whose mastery of synthetic Farming averted famine. Wallace acquired the remains of Tyrell Corporation and created a new line of replicants who obey. Many older models, replicants, Nexus 8s, with open-ended lifespans, survived. They are hunted down and, quote-unquote, retired. Those that hunt them still go by the name.
It's good stuff.
It's a great open. It ranks up there as one of the best opening screen crawls, in my opinion. Better than the screen crawl from Star Wars Episode 9.
The dead speak.
Oh, we're just jumping right into this, aren't we? Okay. But what about, it would have been cool to hear that call. Well, you should have been playing Fortnite.
Yeah.
So I wonder what their target.
I played Fortnite once.
Oh, well. Sorry you disappoint me.
I disappoint myself.
All right. Yeah, so the first thing that really stands out to me is I love the little, it's almost this little side story that we start off with, this own contained short film almost, when Kay comes to visit, what's his name?
Sapper Morton.
Sapper Morton, thank you. First off, we just get a full dose of stunning visuals, and the location is just so gritty. So I was going to say lifelike, but I think you know what I mean. It just feels, it feels alien, but it all feels natural.
Yeah. It feels feasible for like what the future might be, I guess, tangible.
Right, and obviously we got Kay with the coat he's wearing. It's great character introduction, in my opinion.
Yes.
And we have him. I love that interaction where Sapper Morton first walks into the house and Kay is sitting there.
Yeah.
And he makes a reference to, I tried not to track in any dirt. And Morton says to him, "The dirt, I don't mind. It's unwanted visitors."
Yeah.
That just really funny. There's a lot of great dialogue in this scene.
There is. I think this is, it's one of my favorite opening scenes up there with Inglourious Basterds. It sets everything up in the movie perfectly. We get to see who Kay is as a character, what he does, how he feels about it. We get the miracle line, which is literally the whole movie's plot. We get a brutal fist fight where Sapper Morton is literally slamming Kay through a wall.
Right.
And then we get him talking to Madam, what's her name?
Robin Wright.
Yeah. What's her name?
No, what's her like character name, bro?
Yeah. I can't remember for some reason.
It's pretty much because they call her Madam the whole time.
Yeah.
Lieutenant Joshy.
Joshy, that's it. We get introduced to her and her dynamic with Kay, and then we get the little flower. It sets the whole movie, well, like you said, feeling like a little short film. Like if I watched that on YouTube, I'd think it's awesome and be fully satisfied.
That's if you got an extended preview of that film, if they had just shown that before any major blockbuster film, just 5 minutes of that, I think you could have put a lot of people in seats.
For sure. But I want to talk about this movie thematically, because there's so much here. Mm-hmm. One thing I really noticed this time was on the surface level, this is about Officer K discovering that he is born, like he's a replicant, and he was born, which has never happened before. And then he finds out that no, it wasn't him. He's not the chosen one. Yet at the end, he chooses to do the right thing anyway. That's what makes him most human, et cetera, et cetera. It's amazing. We could talk about that alone for hours, but What really gets me is just how replicants are treated in this world, because he is a replicant, but like it might be with his conversation with Sapper, Sapper Morton at the beginning, but he says something like, he asks, he basically discriminates against Sapper Morton because he's an older model, even though he's literally the same thing as Kay. Just because he's an older model, he doesn't deserve to live because he doesn't obey or whatever. Yeah. And it's crazy. But then you see at the other end of the, on the other hand, Kay himself is just hated by most people. Like you see what's written on his door. You hear the cop make the offhand comment when he's back in the station. Like he's not exactly the height of society here. And yet almost to feel like he has some station, some power, he treats other replicants like crap, because I mean, it's his job. He is literally a replicant who was made to kill replicants, which is crazy.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it stood out to me last night when he says, "You're a traitor to your kind." And Cave responds by saying, "I don't kill my kind. My kind doesn't rebel," or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you have that take, because everything leading up to him beating him, beating up Morton, I took away from this thought that I think it's very clear that Kay doesn't want to fight him, and he'd much rather, he says it himself, he'd much rather just, if he can bring him in alive, he'd much rather do that.
Yeah, and something about not doing this on an empty stomach, like it would make him sick to have to do this.
Right, so I didn't take away any thoughts of seeing Kay mistreating another replicant or using his station to abuse others. It seemed like he was he had a job to do. He was designed for a specific job. And like that line later in the film where he says, I didn't realize it was a choice or something like that. I didn't think that was an option. Right. So to me, it seemed like all the comments that Kay makes, this is not what he wants to be doing.
Yeah, maybe it's like he's just reciting the script or something.
Right, because every opportunity he can, even to Morton, Tim, please don't get.
Yeah,
the whole thing. So it's interesting, and then he does what he has to do. And he seems to be pretty callous about it, just because this, I think, much like Rick Deckard in the original film, you have to block options to do the job, it seems like.
Yeah.
And he just got it done back to the HQ there. But it was a really fascinating opening sequence, and seeing them interact with one another, as you mentioned. The miracle line where Morton says you're content eating crap because you've never seen a miracle. I think that's a brilliant line that is played out throughout the remainder of the film. And then as Kay begins to think that he might be the born replicant, maybe appreciating more this idea, this birth, this miracle, and then coming to the realization that he doesn't have to be what they programmed him to be.
Yeah. Yeah. He does. He's made to obey, but he has the ability to make his own decisions.
Right.
There's two other characters I really want to talk about. The first is Love.
Right.
Because Love is kind of the perfect foil to Kay. Whereas Kay here is, he's not trying to be the best replicant. He's not, he's just literally trying to do his job. And he ends up believing he's special because of extraordinary circumstances. And he doesn't really know how to handle that. You can tell multiple times during this part where he thinks he's the born replicant, where he doesn't even know how to feel like that. He can't process that emotionally.
Right.
And on the other hand, love is almost entirely emotionless, but for a few, very few scenes where she actually like angry cries. She is cold and ruthless, and her goal seemingly is to just try to be the best replicant. She almost worships Wallace in this movie. She wants to become more human, not because of her like choices or actions or anything, but just by being as like him as possible. And I think that comes to fruition through the ruthlessness and through, like, even visually, which is a great directing thing, when Wallace kills the new replicant with the knife slash across the stomach. You see, right, when Love uses her knife on people, that's what she does. She does that same action, the slice across the stomach area. She does it on Joshi and Kay at the end. And she's just trying so desperately to impress him and be like him because she thinks that's what humanity is, because that's who made her. But Kay realizes after, I don't know exactly when, we can talk about that maybe, but he realizes humanity isn't about just mimicking them in actions. It's about thinking for yourself and making your own choices.
Yeah, I mean, you feel free to talk about it whenever. But, oh, so I do have I think it's an interesting take on the character of Love. And she has this dialogue at the end of, you know, towards the end of the final fight there, with, and she says to Kay, "I'm the best replicant." And from this perspective, that she is the best replicant in regard to, she does exactly what she was programmed to do. She obeys, and she obeys perfectly. Now you say, and here's where I disagree with you a little bit. You say that she's trying to emulate Wallace, and she might, and she thinks that makes her more human. However, just the character of Love, from my perspective, it seemed like she had no interest in being human because she viewed herself as better than human.
That's fair. And I think your point about the I'm the best one line really supports that. Like, she doesn't want to be human. She just wants to be the best, like, being.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's characterized a couple of times as, you know, the way that she views Officer K. So there's that scene, you know, where he gets ambushed and she fires the drone missile, break up the fight and basically help him because she needs him to do his job so that she can find the born replicant. Yeah.
Literally calls him dog.
Right. And then the scene where Kay and Deckard are ambushed, she comes out. I think she starts like whistling at him like a dog.
Something like that, yeah.
Yes, she views him as nothing. And obviously she considers herself the best replicant. And I'm sure she considers herself far superior to human.
Yeah.
And that's another interesting... Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to say, I can't imagine how she felt while Kay was killing her. Like, she must have just broken inside knowing that she was about to be killed by Kay.
You know, it's an interesting thing about that scene, and it's not something we get a lot. And you may have taken something else away from this, but she's clearly she's the main antagonist of the film, or at least the main antagonist to Kay, right?
Yes, in a physical, yeah. Yes, I agree.
And she does a lot. She kills Joshi. She kills Joy, who we've not even talked about yet.
Yeah, and she kills that poor medical doctor guy.
Right. She does all these evil things that just make you burn up inside. And then, I don't know, watching him choke her to death, you feel this bit of sorrow for her. You, at least for me, I felt bad for her. The brutality of it, but also in the way that she never experiences what it be human.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a line of dialogue by one of these another replicant who's the lead of a rebellion group.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting take. I like that because you do feel a little sad. I think it's because of Wallace's influence that you feel sad because she never even had a chance to be something else.
Right.
Yeah.
She didn't, unlike Kay, she wasn't granted the opportunity to have a choice to decide what she wanted to be. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's lead right into Joy, because Joy mm-hmm. is an amazing character as well, even though she's literally an AI hologram. First off, I just want to say the visual effects utilized with Joy are some of the most impressive visual effects I've ever seen in my life.
Mm.
Yeah, it's absolutely really stunning. Well, yeah. Like, I love the scene when she steps outside in the rain for the first time and you see her programming adjust to simulate the rain on her hand, or right. when she merges with the real girl, like that looked weird, but also really good. Like it's crazy how good Joy looks as a hologram interacting with this world.
Yeah, Joy as a character is, in my opinion, I think she's a really great character, and you get the sense, not only visually, but she's a great, very well-written character. The actress whose name escapes me plays her so brilliantly.
Ana de Armas.
Yes, there we go. And her character is written to be very hollow, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You visually see that she's hollow, as you can see her projection and you can see light passing through from the other side. She is not a real being, right? So Kay is not a human, and she's less so, right?
Yeah.
But also in her dialogue, what she says to Kay is very hollow. So there's this moment, I think it's early in the film, like their first exchange between the two characters, and she says to Kay, "I love you," and he says to her, you don't have to say that, right?
Yeah.
And but she does, because there's this fact that she is a program, right?
Yeah.
And I think and obviously Kay is not a program, and he does have his own mind, regardless of whether it's he is programmed or, you know, designed and built, made. But I think there's this internal struggle that we see Kay go through that's not necessarily verbalized, where he maybe is struggling. At least I took away that he kind of struggles with the fact that he doesn't know whether what she says to him is because she means it, or if it's because that's what the programming tool is telling her to say, right?
Yeah, yeah. I definitely get that sense too, but I don't necessarily feel, and I'm not saying you feel this way, but I don't necessarily feel it's all negative. I think...
No, I'm sorry. I meant that to say... I'm sorry. I want to hear finish your thought, but I just meant, I think that's how her character was written to be.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't think it's a negative.
Gotcha. Yeah, I agree. I love that you picked up on Kay feeling conflicted about her, because I totally get that sense too, especially during the first scene we see them interact in the apartment.
Right.
But I do think Kay genuinely does care about her,
mm-hmm.
because she is literally all he has in terms of companionship. Like, he is so lonely, so isolated, hated by 90% of the people he sees.
Exactly.
And just having Joy, though she's a program and though she's fake, gives him someone to talk to and someone to love and someone to share his feelings with. And you see that relationship build. And even though it's programming, you get the sense, and I'm not saying the programming has emotions or anything, but you get the sense that Joy does care about him back, and she at least displays those thoughts and feelings to him. And of course he'd reciprocate that sort of thing, because even though, yes, it's this code telling her to act that way, nobody else is acting that way toward him.
Right.
And just, man, I don't know about you, but especially the first time I saw the movie, watching Love stomp on the Emanator and quote unquote kill Joy, just that hurt.
Kill Joy.
Yeah. And actually, yeah, that's kind of symbolic. She killed Joy, and she really was the Joy Kay had in life.
Right. And it's the permanence of it. She's gone forever. Yeah. There's no bringing her back. And it was for nothing.
Yeah.
And we don't often see that in films.
Yeah. There was no purpose to her death. It just happened.
Right.
I think, and I love, one second. I love the line when he's deleting her from the home console and just putting her on the Emanator. And he says, if something happens to this, you'll die. And she says, yeah, just like a real girl. And
right.
I don't know how AI works in this world. I don't know if she's actually artificially intelligent, or this all is a program, or if she's learning and growing as a, like, not a living thing, but a pseudo living thing. But if she clearly wants to be more human and more real. And that sense of danger given by her being transferred solely to the Emanator makes her that much closer to being real, because she has mortality now.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting from the perspective, at least what I took away, is this: does she have her own desire to be more of a real girl, or is her program trying to figure out what A wants her to be?
Yeah.
Trying to adapt to something that makes a more satisfying product for K.
Yeah, because all love ever refers to Joy as is a product. I hope you enjoyed our product. Or,
right.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting how Joy only speaks to three people, I think, in the whole film?
Who's the third?
Well, she speaks to Love. She speaks to Kay, obviously. Hey. And then she speaks to, what's her face?
Joshy?
No, the
I'm totally blanking. I'm sorry.
The real girl.
Oh yeah. I don't remember her name.
Yeah.
The rebellion real girl.
Yeah, her.
Yeah.
Further giving this illusion that she's not real, and when she speaks to, not illusion, but furthering the reality that she is not real. And when she speaks to Love, I don't think Love says a word to her. She just walks up and says to Kay, I hope you are satisfied with our product.
Yeah.
And then destroys the Emanator.
Yes. Yeah. And I think, man, one of the hardest scenes for me to watch is Kay after he finds out he's not the born one, and he's on that skywalk and he sees the Joy advertisement, the mm-hmm. pink Joy advertisement.
Yeah.
I feel like he just realizes this is a huge turning point in the movie. I feel like he realizes, like, the one thing he cared about, the one thing he thought cared about him, just, it literally is a product designed to make him happy. And he doesn't, I feel like he realizes that there's a chance none of that was real and it was all just fake programming.
He
just in that moment is like, I feel like that's what spurs him to do something real and make his own choice and become more human.
Yeah, I thought that was really, no, that's a good point you make. I thought that was really clever when she takes to calling him Joe because he's, you know, a real boy, right?
Yeah.
And then the advertisement there refers to him as Joe, and he kind of has this epiphany moment, realizing, or at least having an overwhelming suspicion that none of his relationship, if you will, with Joy was real.
Yeah, it was all just to help him be a satisfied customer.
Right. And it's interesting. When we get to that point with Kay, where he's at in the story, it's interesting that he goes from just a replicant trying to do his job almost for survival's sake, because if you don't do your job, you know, you're going to get retired.
Yeah.
To suspecting that he might be the born replicant, to utterly devastated when he believes that he's the born replicant, right?
Yeah.
To when it's Deckard having this moment of realization, and I think it's a subtle one, but causes his reaction a few scenes later to be when he realizes he's not the born one, to be just utterly devastated. Having that exchange with Deckard and him, Deckard asking Deckard questions about Rachel and the child, and asks Deckard why he left, and he said, you know, that was the plan. Yeah. I left because that was the plan. Making Kay realize, and it's interesting, and I'll get to my point, but it's interesting that Deckard asks him his name. He says Kay, and then he says, no, that's a serial number. What's your name? And then I think he's the only character aside from Joy that calls him Joe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because Deckard views him, whether he's a replicant or not, as real. And I think that's hit home by when Kay asks Deckard if the dog is real. And he says, I don't know, ask him, right? Like Deckard at this point doesn't care.
He doesn't care. He just, the dog's real to him because there's a dog there and it cares about him. And right. Kay is real because he's there.
And then I'll finish my point about Kay here, and then I have another point about Deckard. But so having that exchange with Deckard makes him realize, or makes him appreciate or want to be a part of something more, something not just something special, but something more, having meaning, his life having meaning, not just being another product of Wallace.
Yeah, and I think that could contribute to why he went to help Deckard, because Deckard was the only one who ever treated him like a human.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's fascinating because just in that instance, whether he wanted to be, I don't think at first he ever wanted to be the born replicant, but just in a flicker of a moment, his life went from being actually pointless to his life having meaning.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. And I think it makes it absolutely devastating when he finds out he's not. But with Deckard, I think it's so interesting what we just discussed, how now he doesn't care whether he doesn't care whether Kay is a replicant or not. He calls him Joe. To him, he's real. And he doesn't care whether the dog is a replicant or not. Artificial, and it doesn't matter, which is really an action from where he was 30 years ago in the film's universe, in the original Blade Runner, where his job was to kill replicants, and you could see him, as we discussed last week, struggling, overcoming this fact that he gets the shakes after killing replicants, and just this having to fight with what he believes in his mind and what he sees with his eyes, right?
Yeah, and also the fact that a replicant saved his life.
Exactly, exactly. So I think it's really cool. And then obviously this line, the fact that it doesn't matter whether it's the dog's a replicant or not, hit home with the identity, Deckard's own identity, when he talks to Wallace, and Wallace is alluding to him being either human or a replicant, asking, you know, questioning whether that first interaction with Rachel was due to love or mathematics.
Right.
I think that's great.
Yeah. And I slightly changing the subject, I just love how they don't acknowledge or disavow either side of the Deckard as a replicant thing. They just kind of ignore it. Wallace says something like, it was like the way you were designed. And then everyone's like, oh, he's a replicant. And then like a second later, he says, if you were designed. And they're like, oh, well, we still don't know. And that's all the movie does to touch on it.
Right. And I think it hits back to this point. You might disagree, but the point I made that it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't. It really doesn't.
Yeah. Or earlier in the film, when he goes to see Edward James Olmos' character, what's his name?
Gaff?
Yeah, he goes to see Gaff. And Gaff says, Deckard doesn't long for this world. And Kay asks him what he means, and he says, there's something about his eyes.
Yeah.
I thought it was really funny.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think Villeneuve really, I think it was smart for him not to take any side on that.
Yeah, because you're right. It doesn't matter. The fact is, Deckard, replicant or not, has proved himself human enough that it shouldn't be contentious.
Right. And what's the line that resistance replicant, the one with the one eye, says to Deckard, Kay, when he realizes he's not the born one? She says, to be human is to, I wish I could remember.
Yeah, I've been trying to remember for a while now. She says some line like about what it means to be human, and it's good, but I can't remember. I'm going to look it up real quick.
I'm doing the same thing.
Oh, you got it. But yeah, I think we can use this to transition into talking about the ending. The ending scene when Kay decides to save Deckard is that's a human choice that he made, and he goes to do it, and we get the fight and everything, which is very tense and cool. And then I love the line where Deckard, they land outside the memory place where the trueborn replicant is. And Deckard says, who am I to you? Like, why are you doing this, basically? Because the interesting thing about that to me is this whole time, Deckard's looking at him like, who is this guy? Why is he doing this? But from the moment Kay saw Deckard, Kay is like, since he thought he was the born, Kay is like, that's my dad. Kay has this huge emotional attachment to him. And even after he finds out he's not the born replicant, he probably still feels some sense of connection to him. Whereas Deckard the whole time is like, who is this guy? And I love that Kay's just, go see your daughter now, because it doesn't matter who he is at this point. He made the human choice, and he lays down and dies. And it doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things for the most part, but it matters to Deckard, because that replicant, Officer K, helped him find his daughter.
Mm.
So no matter what happened, even if it's just a splash, a drop in the bucket, Deckard will remember K because of what he did and what he chose to do.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. And then I want to point out that scene is so brilliantly stunning. We've had these gritty, dirty cityscapes for 2 hours and 30 minutes in these, you know, abandoned deserts, and then we get this, the crisp, clean, sanitary design that is this, the dreams are there with the snow outside, and then inside it's all clean. It's such a brilliant contrast. And then seeing Kay lay there in the, on the steps in the snow.
Yeah.
Just so, it's just such a brilliant, brilliant shot.
It is. And I feel like it kind of is meant to represent a place of peace and Kay finally coming to terms with himself and being okay with who he turned out to be. And I feel like he's content just laying there and dying.
Right. Now, is that meant to be ambiguous whether he dies or not, or does he die?
I don't think it's ever clarified. I think he died. Some people probably think he didn't. I don't know what you think, but I definitely think he died, because I feel like he feels that he fulfilled his purpose and he doesn't need to live anymore, as he's literally bleeding out because he got slashed across the stomach.
Right. And it goes back to that line we were discussing, dying for the right cause. It's the most human thing we can do.
Yes, that's what it was.
So it would track thematically if he dies.
Yeah, I think he does. Random fun fact. I believe that shot of, or the concept of him dying on the steps and then having that ambiguous ending, is a reference to Cowboy Bebop.
Yeah, that's random. And I don't know. I can neither agree nor disagree with you.
Just watch episode 26 of Cowboy Bebop and you'll understand.
Yeah, so it's him dying for the right cause, most human thing he can do.
And he did.
In part because it's his choice.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I adore the last shot of the movie of Deckard walking up to the glass and seeing his daughter and just kind of reaching his hand out. And then it just cuts to black. Mm. Like, that's it. That's the story. That's all we needed. We see closure. We see Deckard find his daughter. We see Kay become the human he wanted to be. And that's it. Right. Nothing else. We don't need some wrap-up scene. We just, you feel content, and it's awesome. Mm.
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant ending.
Yeah.
Now, we've covered pretty much all the big stuff, right?
We're not missing,
forgetting anyone? Okay.
Yeah.
So now, why did it fail at the box office? What are your thoughts? I have thoughts. I want to hear yours first.
I think Blade Runner, the original Blade Runner itself, was never hugely popular. Even still, it's pretty cult classic status. And the fact that the sequel is so many years later, I mean, I don't know, man. I guess people just weren't interested. The marketing wasn't, there wasn't like a huge marketing budget or anything. I never saw a ton of ads. Just, it makes me sad. I don't think it ever was going to do super well. Because I feel like those who love Blade Runner would go see 2049. But I don't feel like 2049 would draw in any new people. Like, oh, what's this? I should go watch it. Not knowing what Blade Runner is, because it's very slow. It's not a sci-fi action movie. It's a lot of things. I'm sure you have more concrete ideas than I do. All I know is it makes me sad that this thing didn't even crack 100 million at the domestic box office.
We're just going to have to pause here for a second. I just got a notification saying my microphone switched. Do I sound the same?
Yeah, you sound the same.
Okay, I don't know what was going on there. Okay.
All good.
All right, I'm going to start. Yeah, so it's interesting. Villeneuve was talking about, in retrospect, saying that they're kind of confused as to what happened because they were projected to do really well in the box office and they didn't. And I think it's a multi-tiered thing. One, its length. It's 2 hours and 43 minutes, I believe, or just about there. And there's a lot going on. It never seems slow to me. Ridley Scott was critiquing it, saying it should have been about 30 minutes shorter. I just don't see how you could.
No, it shouldn't have been any shorter.
I don't see how you could remove 30 minutes. Obviously, there are long pan shots, like when he's walking through deserted Las Vegas there. But I don't think there's that much. And maybe I'm just. It just never occurred to me that this was a long film. I mean, Interstellar was 2 hours and 43 minutes as well, about that time. And it didn't suffer in the box office. So
yeah,
I don't think that's the, I think the issue goes back to, I think it's not a very approachable film. Like a film such as Interstellar is, you need a lot of prep, like you were discussing, to be able to go sit down and watch and appreciate 2049. Like, for example, the first original Blade Runner flopped in the box office. It's only since then become a hit, and that's only after there were seven different cuts of the film.
No kidding.
So it's a very unapproachable franchise at that, from that standpoint. It's also very confusing having seven different cuts, and the people who watched it in theaters in 1982 and then go to get a Blu-ray copy now and it's the final cut are going to be confused. It's also like you said, it's a cult classic. I think it's a bit obscure of a film.
Yeah, it's from like just watching both of the movies, it's not accessible in like a popcorn action sort of way. Neither are action movies. These are science fiction, like dramas almost.
Right.
There's very little action. It's more about character and plot and stuff. And I think because of that, people would probably expect, like just based on trailers, they'd probably expect, oh, this is cool sci-fi. We'll get cool laser fights and spaceships and stuff. But no, that's not what it's about.
Right. And so, and that's not to say that there isn't action, because I think there's plenty of action. And I think it's a lot of very well choreographed action.
Oh, yeah. But that's not the sole purpose.
Agreed. So this film, not approachable. You get new people, new audience. You're trying to pull in a new audience here who hasn't seen a film from 30 years prior. They see a nearly 3 hour film that requires you to watch a film from 1982, 83 to fully understand. And even then you might have to take multiple viewings. It's just...
Yeah. Not going to work out for the box office favor.
In concept, it didn't seem like it was going to be commercially successful.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate, because I think a lot of people missed out on a really good story because they maybe needed to cut through a little red tape to be able to sit down and appreciate it.
Yeah. But man, am I glad Denis Villeneuve made it. And because of 2049, I cannot wait for his adaptation of Dune.
Yeah, that's going to be, I think it's, the trailer looked very visually stunning. It's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, I'm very excited. Sadly, it was delayed like a year.
But that was to be expected.
Yeah. Anyway, in the end, 2049... it's one of my favorites of all time. 5 stars, easy. I highly recommend it.
Oh, I completely forgot. I teased it in the opening. There was one critique I had.
Oh, yeah.
I'll get it out. I'll just say it briefly now. My only critique, my lone critique, is the character Neandra Wallace. I think he kind of just shows up. I know he's supposed to, he views himself as a godlike character, obviously, because of the fact that he creates far more so than what's the guy's name from
Tyrell,
far more than Tyrell ever seemed. But it's just his presence there at film, he just disappears and he never shows back up again.
Right? Yeah, he's in two scenes.
I don't know. I think they could have done a better job of writing that character just a little bit. But
that's fair.
We've talked ad nauseum, so I won't get any further. 5 stars, great film.
Yes, agreed.
So are you about ready to move into our second segment then?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So our second segment this week is 5 perfect film endings. So each of us have made a list of 5 films that we think have perfect endings. They're not necessarily our favorite films, and they're not necessarily, because there are so many films out there that we've seen, they're not necessarily our absolute, these are our top 5 favorite film endings, but these are some of the 5 that we think are the absolute best.
Yes, 5 of our favorites.
5 of our favorites, and there, I don't have them ranked. I'm assuming you don't either.
I don't either, and also, we don't know the others, so there might be overlap here.
So, before we started recording, you said that you had a prediction.
Yes. I have two predictions now, actually, because I've been thinking.
Okay.
Do you want me to guess?
Yeah, I want you to guess.
I think you have both Logan and Whiplash on your list.
Okay. Interesting. Well, we will see if you're right. You want to go first?
Yeah, I'll start out. This is basic. This is boring, but I just love it. It's Blade Runner 2049. That ending is too good. We just talked about it a ton, but everything from the closing scene and watching Kay die to watching Deckard meet his daughter, it's perfect. I couldn't imagine changing any single thing about that ending.
Are you sure? I don't think we talked about it.
You sure?
I don't remember it.
We talked about it a bunch. At least I did. you were busy looking for the quote.
I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah, I'm sure.
All right. So my first selection is Unforgiven. Unforgiven. Nice. Yeah. It's a film, we've not had it as the centerpiece of an episode yet, but it's one that we've talked, I think, referenced a lot on this podcast.
Good.
Obviously, it inspired films like Logan, but I won't break down the plot, but just him, Will Money entering that bar after, I forget Morgan Freeman's character's name, but after is that character dies after all he went through, and he walks into the bar and that whole showdown there in the bar with Gene Hackman's character, just brilliant.
It's great.
The tension, the setting, Clint Eastwood being just his usual self, his usual bad self.
Yeah, that is a great ending because it's the perfect culmination of his character undevelopment.
Yeah. I love that he takes the shotgun in because he can't shoot worth a piss with lever action.
Yeah. That's a great ending. Good choice.
Thank you.
My next one, you know, this one's also pretty obvious. Inception. I will tout Inception to the day I die. It's the movie that got me into movies, but that ending leaves you pulling your hair out and just, it's, I don't know if it's a cliffhanger per se, but, and it does thematically work, but that first viewing where you watch Inception and you see the top and it's spinning and spinning and you're like, is it gonna fall? And then you see it wobble slightly and then it cuts to black and you just kind of stare blankly at the screen. It's the most.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, exactly. It's one of the most thought-provoking endings ever. And yes, like I said, thematically it does work because the point is that it doesn't matter whether or not he's in a dream because he's found his kids and he's satisfied that he's home, etc. He's accepted his reality. But it's just, it's such a brilliant ending. And I think if they had made it definite by either showing the top spinning forever or showing it fall, that would have taken away a lot of the magic of Inception.
So I have two questions and a statement. The first statement is a rhetorical question.
That was a ride.
It was a thrill. Which is why, if Cobb's father or father-in-law was traveling to Europe to teach, why couldn't he at any point have taken Cobb's children to come see him?
I don't know, man.
Second question. Do you think that he's in a dream, or do you think he's in reality?
Cop-out answer, I think he's in his reality. But real answer, I think he's in reality, yes.
Or maybe, just maybe, he's in... Oh, what's the guy? What's the businessman's name that hires him?
Fisher? Robert Fisher?
No.
Oh, Saito.
Yeah, maybe he's in Saito's reality. Maybe it's all in a dream that Saito set up. Maybe.
I don't think so.
No. Okay, so, and then I think he is awake. My reasoning for that is, if he were in a dream, the top never even for a split second would lose momentum, which is why it would topple. I don't think it never topples or even begins to topple in any of the other sequences when he's in a dream. Though I don't think he uses the top. No, yeah, like with Maul. And Maul, when he spins the top in the dollhouse there.
Yeah.
And it just spins forever. It doesn't waver. So that's my theory.
Yeah. Great ending, though. I love it.
So I will say, when I was making this list, I wanted to do five films that I thought had great and perfect endings that I hadn't really talked about. So,
well, that's not the case for mine.
But I was like, yeah, I've spoken about Logan a lot. I've spoken about La La Land a lot. So I didn't include films like that on this list. However, I did include Whiplash.
There it is.
The final 15 minutes, if any good action film or any good science fiction film, or really any film, has this climactic fight at the end. So like in Blade Runner 2049, it was the fight between Love and Kay. This film, the final fight is between Fletcher and what is Teller's name in this film?
His name is Miles Teller. I've always called him Miles Teller.
Okay. Fletcher and Miles, this duel, they get, well, you've seen the film, getting up on stage.
Yeah.
And Fletcher basically screwing him by not giving the right pieces of music to prep in advance, and feeling defeated, feeling dejected. Miles goes to leave, embarrassed, humiliated. And then finally, he gets this moment of brilliance where he decides to step up to the challenge that Fletcher has issued, and he goes up there and, definitely without Fletcher ever expecting he'd do this, starts going off on his own drum riff. And it's so compelling. He basically requires the other members of the band to follow suit. And then at first Fletcher is furious with him, but then starts vibing with him. And then that final shot of Fletcher conducting him, and then you get this smile, this genuine smile, not this devious smile, but this genuine smile on Fletcher's face as he's just absolutely thrilled he's found his Charlie Parker.
Yeah.
Great ending.
It is a great ending, and it's widely regarded for a reason, I'd say.
Yeah.
Yeah. My third one is La La Land.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I've got these covered for you.
I knew you'd have it, so I wasn't going to.
I got the basics for you. I mean, we talked about La La Land ad nauseum, the ending, just the whole fantasy sequence of what me and Sebastian's life could have looked like together, followed by that, just the look and the slight nod as Mia leaves the bar with her husband, it's one of the most heartbreaking endings ever. But you also know that they're both where they belong.
The most bittersweet ending of all time.
Yeah, for sure.
And we talked about this episode in the same episode. We talked about this film in the same episode we discussed Hitch, starring Will Smith and Eva Mendes. And at no point in that episode did we make the connection that Ryan Gosling and Eva Mendes are married.
Well, I didn't say that because I didn't know that, but I'm glad you do.
I didn't know it at the time either, and it was kind of embarrassing in the after fact.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Right.
Third entry. This is big franchise entry. The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King.
Oh, that. Wow. I'm sorry. Okay. You can talk. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I love, maybe this is going to rub you the wrong way. I love that Peter Jackson, he altered the ending of the franchise from what the trilogy was in the books. So in the books, Saruman is not killed at his tower there by Grima Wormtongue. Instead, he kind of goes into isolation, and then as the hobbits are returning from destroying the ring, they come back to Hobbiton and realize that Saruman has taken over Hobbiton and the Shire, and they have to fight to liberate their home. I think it's fun. I think it's really, really interesting. However, thematically, it just doesn't fit. Having the climax of what we've been building up to for three films now, building up to the destruction of the ring, and then going back home and having to do this whole other unrelated task of defeating Saruman. I thought it was smart of Peter Jackson and his team to rework that a bit so Saruman was killed earlier in the story, so that final climax with the ring, everything was resolved. I think it's great. And then we get the reunion, and maybe you call it corny or whatever, but you get the reunion of all the characters who haven't seen one another since the end of the Fellowship of the Ring. I think it's brilliant. I think the score by Howard Shore is beautiful, and the Aragorn being crowned king of Gondor, it's great. It ties up all its loose ends, and I think it's a good summarization of what J.R.R. Tolkien wrote. And obviously, it won Best Picture in 2003. So there we go.
I'm glad you like it.
You haven't seen the film in like 10 years.
There are 1,200 endings to that movie. It ends so many times. It takes 45 minutes to end. How is this on a list of best endings?
That's an exaggeration.
No, it's...
I'm not. I don't understand your contempt for The Lord of the Rings. It kind of...
I respect it. I think it's a very impressive filmmaking feat, but I also think it's boring.
When was the last time you saw it?
Saw it? I've seen bits and pieces over the previous 4 years. The last time I watched the whole thing in full was probably 10 years ago.
Okay, so the last time you saw it, you were 12.
12 or 13, yeah.
I'm sorry, I just can't accept that as a...
I liked the Fellowship book. It's a good book. Two Towers is boring. Couldn't make it past page 2 of Return of the King.
And yet you managed to find time to read all 7 Harry Potter novels.
10 times.
I just don't think your critiques of the Lord of the Rings films are valid because you haven't seen them in 10 years since you were a child. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm sorry that I dislike your pick.
Oh, I don't care if you dislike it.
My next pick is...
Sucks. I hate it.
You do hate you do hate Knives Out, yeah.
I hate it.
Mine is Knives Out. Because, and this is more, yes, the ending is great and figuring
out... Spoiler, the jerk did it.
The jerk did it. Chris Evans did it. It's a great movie. That's a great ending. But really, I'm talking about the last shot, which is just the best. You have oh, what's her name? Marta. Marta on the balcony in her house.
Joy?
Looking down over the family, and they're just looking up at her like, well, what are we going to do now? And she's just has her mug, my house, my coffee, my house, my rules, takes a sip, and it ends. And it's just so perfect because she deserves that house. And it's hilarious.
Freaking brilliant. I love it.
I cannot wait to see what Rian Johnson does next. I want the sequel to that movie.
Benoit Blanc.
That's my fourth one. What were you going to say?
Also, no, I was just going to say, and one final point on Return of the King. It wraps up three films, and I think it does it brilliantly. Maybe it drags on a little, but I think it does it well. That's just my opinion. Okay. The next one. Steve Jobs.
Cool.
Freaking brilliant film.
I haven't seen it.
That is your loss. I loved this film. I loved it more than The Social Network, also written by Aaron Sorkin. It's a beautiful film. The dialogue, everything is so clever, but the ending is just, it's so full of nuggets of great dialogue and story and character development. And then you have this, and I don't want to spoil it, but this relationship between Steve Jobs and this other character, and it coming into its final fruition. You see how it's evolved from the beginning of the film to the end. It's just so beautiful, so well crafted. I'm not sure how historically accurate it is. I'm sure it's not very, but it's just so well crafted. Aaron Sorkin did a great job on that film, and the ending is spectacular. My review of it on Letterboxd is freaking brilliant film. 5 stars.
Wow. That's awesome. I'll have to check it out sometime. My last one here. This is my slightly less obvious one. The Usual Suspects.
Ooh, I have not seen it.
That's unfortunate because now I can't talk about the ending. It's the greatest twist ending of all time.
Awesome.
That's what I will say. Kaiser Soze.
Now I will be expecting a twist when I'm watching it.
You've ruined it. Everyone knows Usual Suspects has a twist.
I didn't.
Well, now you do. Now you're in with everyone. Yeah. I'm not going to say anything other than Kaiser Soze. What's your last one?
I feel like the whole film is ruined for me now. I just need to process. No. My final selection, I think this is the most perfect film ending I've seen in a long time. The Iron Giant. Now, this was probably my favorite film up there with Dinosaurs and Tarzan as a child. And I'm speaking like 7 years old, younger than that. Absolutely love The Iron Giant. I could watch that thing over and over again, but I haven't seen it in like 15, probably over a decade now. And I sat down to watch it again this week for the first time in a while. Watched the Signature Edition, which was a lot of fun. And I watched the ending. And it is absolutely thematically, beat for beat, perfect. You've seen the film, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this line of dialogue, you choose... what's the line? You choose what you want to be.
Yeah.
Right. And the whole crux of this Brad Bird's like statement in this film is, what if a gun had a soul? Right. So the Iron Giant is this weapon of mass destruction that doesn't want to be a weapon. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he chooses, after the military attacks him, and then they realize that he is good, or at least not a threat. And the town realizes that he saves the two children, and the nuclear bomb is coming in, or the atom bomb, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And he chooses to be Superman. I think you can say it's a little simple. He chooses to be Superman, but he chooses to be good. He chooses to do something good. He doesn't have to be what they've programmed him to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very similar to Officer K, if you think about it.
You're not wrong, actually. The Iron Giant was the Blade Runner 2049 before Blade Runner 2049.
That's right. And it flopped at the box office, too. It was It was beyond people's...
beyond their understanding.
Beyond their understanding. If I was doing a list where I was doing like my absolute favorites and I wasn't taking into account the frequency of the films I've talked about, I would have probably thrown on 2049, Logan, La La Land.
Yeah.
But I want it to be... I want it to be fun, unique, original. And so I think this
I want it to be boring and
bland.
Bland.
Blah. And then the one unique one that we have never discussed, The Usual Suspects, that you can't talk about.
Like, honestly, most other twist endings I wouldn't have a problem spoiling, but it's so legendary that...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now I'm expecting a twist.
There it is.
Very disappointing.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think that's it, right? Five each?
Yeah, I think that'll do it. Awesome. Next week, you want to tell them what we're doing next week?
Yes. Next week, we're watching Bad Times at the El Royale, which I am so excited for. Forrest, you finally have to watch it because it's finally available for rental.
Yay.
I don't know why you're so not excited about it. It's really great.
I don't know. Why do you hate Lord of the Rings?
I gave my reasoning. I think it's boring.
Well, that'll be my reason next week.
I'm sure it will.
All right. That'll do it for today's podcast. I have been Forrest. He has been Elijah. You guys have been beautiful. This has been We Watch Movies. And until next time, stay fresh.
Spicy.
No, wait,